Welcome everyone to our Rise of Haman Purim class, and it is appropriate that we're here at the JCC and that today would be the Fast of Esther, except that it's a Jewish leap year. It's a Shana Me'uberes. Every year or so, it's 7 years out of 19 years, we add a 13th month, which becomes known as Adar Sheni, the second Adar. So we're in the month right now, would be tonight, the Megillah reading, and then Purim, the whole spiel. But that will happen in a month from now. So today was Tinus Esther, the fast of Esther, Katan, the small one. So I fasted for 5 minutes, and then I have my coffee. Okay, a little. If only we could have such short little fasts, right? I remember my brother always used to eat a very hearty breakfast. So somebody said, Jonathan, why are you so ravished? He says, well, it's called the break the fast. I've been fasting for 9 hours, sleeping. So obviously, I'm fasting. I need to eat. All right. So today, in honor of the Purim of tonight, tomorrow, so we're going to have actual Purim Katan, the Manir Purim, tonight, tomorrow, over Shabbat, will be Shushan Purim Katan. So it's going to be fun. So let's talk about the origin story of Haman. Now, every superhero and supervillain has an origin story. They even make movies on the origin stories. Batman Begins, The Joker. They make movies about the origin stories of the superheroes, how they became who they became, the backstory, right? If you remember, they made a fabulous movie on Captain America, the original Captain America, the first Avenger, and they gave him the backstory when he was a weakling and how he got the medicine. So everybody deserves an origin story, villain or hero. So we're going to talk about Haman's rise. So in order to understand the origin story of Haman, we need to go back to his origins. So Haman is from the Amalekite nation. And the Amalek nation were the ones who first rose up against the Jewish people in a place called Rephidim. In one of our previous classes, we touched on this. Rephidim was a place where the Jewish people questioned, where was God exactly? Is God in our midst or not? And because of that, the Amalek nation attacked us at that point. We won the war at that point. And God declares an eternal war, Lidor Dor, for all generations, we're going to fight against Amalek. Now, if you fast forward from that point into the future, you get to a man named King Saul, Shaul HaMelech. And King Saul was the very first Jewish king of the Jewish people. He was from the tribe of Benjamin, Binyamin. So he wasn't destined to hold on to the Malchut, the kingship forever. That was given to Judah, to David. And if you know your story from the book of Samuel, it's not a great end for poor Saul, who's a very pious, righteous individual. Why do we mention King Saul? Because King Saul, Shaul HaMelech, happens to be the great-grandfather of both Esther and Mordechai. So there's a whole tie-in to the family of Benjamin. Because remember, we're told that who is Mordechai? Ish Yimini, a Benjamin man. Now, where does Haman fit into that? Wow. Well, one of two things that Saul did wrong when he disobeyed God's direct tzivoy, his command. The second was the big one, where he was to make a war with the Amalekite nation, and he spared Agag, Melech Amalek. Agag, king of Amalek, was given a reprieve from an immediate death sentence. And he was brought in chains. And Samuel was very displeased. And this cost Saul his kingdom. It's very, very tragic. Very, very sad. And King Agag lives another day. Because what happened? In the time that Saul chose to spare his life, and then Samuel subsequently himself takes care of business and wipes out Agag, unbeknownst to all of them, Agag had marital relations with his significant other, and he was able to carry on his genetics. And he even says out loud, you know, the sting of death is not so painful anymore because I have carried on my legacy. And how do we know that there is a direct correlation, familially, between Agag, king of the Amalekite nation, and Haman, because when we first meet Haman, he's described as Ha'agagi in the Megillah. In the Megillah's Esther, the book of Esther, it says he's the Agagite. What's an Agagite? That means a child of King Agag, that nefarious king of Amalek, whose life was spared temporarily by King Saul, that allowed the birth of one of Haman's ancestors. So Haman directly comes, cause and effect, from that. So that's the origin story of Haman's genealogy. Now, Haman himself doesn't really show up in the Megillah by name until the third chapter, the rise of Haman. And yet, he actually does. He appears in the first chapter, but he appears with a pseudonym. He's not listed by his real name, and this is when it gets really interesting. So before we touch on his rise, let's talk about what was going on in that first chapter. You read the first party. Ahasuerus was not of great royal lineage, ancestry. And he and his queen Vashti, who did hail from the family of Belshazzar and King Nebuchadnezzar, so she had royalty, she was a real princess, beautiful, and she fit the bill, you know, and that's why he married her. The two of them were partners in crime, and they wanted to reinvent the entire Babylonian kingdom into something different. And in fact, one of the first things they did was move the capital city to the location of where the story of the Purim story takes place, called Shushan. Shushan was simply the summer capital. It was not the original Nebuchadnezzar Belshazzar capital of this empire. It was a new invention. So it's like they took Washington, D.C. and shelved it, and then moved the capital to somewhere else, to Atlanta or something. So that was a new innovation meant to sort of disassociate themselves from the past. And he throws this huge party on the third year of his reign. And the purpose of the party is to cement his leadership, that of his wife Vashti, who also concurrently with the male party throws a female party in her part of the palace. And for 6 months, 180 days, the party goes on, because he rules over 127 provinces and states, all the way Mehodu from India to Kush, to Ethiopia and Africa. The known world, the settled world, belongs to the empire of King Ahasuerus. And he's really the world's first politician, because he's very politically savvy. In fact, it's fascinating. The Talmud, the Gemara, discusses about whether King Ahasuerus was a genius or was a fool. Strange, right? Because you talk about outliers of debate. There's a little bit of a separation there between being this savvy politician and the fool, but maybe both are true, because a person's ego can allow themselves to be manipulated. And if you look at the story, it's very clear that Haman, Esther manipulate the king. They play to his weaknesses. And ego is the greatest weakness that a king can have, surely. And that's why, who is the greatest Jew of all time? We say Moshe, Moses. And what defined Moses? What made him deserving of being Moshe, the Moses who got the Torah from God directly to give to the Jewish people? Because he was the Anav. He was Mr. Humility. He had an objective perspective on who he wasn't and who he was. And he credited everything to God. That, in and of itself, allows the person leadership. And of course, you remember from Moses, Moses didn't want the leadership. He haggled around that burning bush for 7 days. Long debate with God. He wanted anyone else but himself. Again, he wasn't a wallflower. So when we think of humility, we think of, you know, but the lack of humility, which Ahasuerus had in a very big way, his gaiva, his arrogance, was perhaps what the Gemara refers to when it says he's a shota, he's a fool. Because if you have that type of arrogance, people can manipulate you and play to your ego, which they all did. Okay, so let's set the stage now for the party. So 6 months pass. They spent copious amounts of the wealth of the empire on this party. And then he has a second party, 7 days. And who is invited to this party? Essentially, the localites. the ones who are nearest and dearest to Ahasuerus and Vashti, or he wants to be nearest and dearest to them, they're the lovers of the king and his inner circle, and they have a seven-day party, a lavish party, more lavish than the 180-day party that everyone was invited to and then kind of went home. And as people were leaving, he said, no, not so fast there. I have seven more days of lavish feasting and drinking. And the drinking was beyond words. And in fact, the Megillah goes out of its way to discuss how much wine they consumed. And in fact, it was vintage wine. How do we know this? Because the Talmud tells us that he had vintage wines because you had to drink a wine 1 year older than your actual age. So thankfully, Methuselah didn't come to this party. Sorry. Contrary to the, it ain't necessarily so, Methuselah was not 900 years. He was 969 years. But be that as it may, they didn't have to look for a 970-year-old vintage wine. And there was no coercive elements there. Everyone had a beautiful mug, you know, a beautiful gold goblet. And there could not be coercion because Ahasuerus wanted the Jews, specifically targeting the Jews, to come to this lavish seven-day party to feast and not worry about the status of the wine, whether the wine was sacramental wine that had been used for idolatry, whether it had a proper OU certification on it or not. He wanted the Hanhala, the leadership of the Jewish people in Shushan, to join him. And of course, Rabbi Mordechai, who was the chief rabbi of the Jews of Shushan, he forbid his people from going. But what do you think the Jews did? They ignored the rabbi, and many of them went. And this was a cause and effect for God's anger against the Jewish people for disobeying the edict of their rabbi Mordechai. So be that as it may, the party goes on for 7 days. Copious amounts of drink, food beyond, and the descriptions, you'll read the Megillah yourself. There's like verse after verse where it tells you of the purple adornments and the carpets and the, you know, the hangings and the, it was like the best. You ever hear the word in Yiddish, farpitzt? So when a person gets, a lady, let's say, gets made up, puts on 25 layers of makeup, you know, one of the Hollywood actresses to go out, you, I don't know who would, you know, comes to like Sophia Loren or something, you know, when she was about 50 or 60. You can imagine she applied a few layers of makeup. So that's what it means to become farpitzed. So they farpitzed the entire palace there in Shushan. It was quite the event. Now everything, every detail had been planned down to the nth detail by Ahasuerus and Vashti. This was their desire to manipulate everybody and to get them ensconced on the throne, to have a new vision going forward. Now, it was all brought to a crashing defeat because what happened on the seventh day? Well, you know the story. The king and his inner circle are drunk. And of course, Mishenichnas Hayayin Yotzei Hasod, as we are told, when the wine comes in, when the wine flows, the secrets come out. And they started, the men in the inner palace, and the ladies again are not there, because again, they were not exactly, you know, tzinias, modest young ladies. Vashti was anything but, she was the antithesis of this, but she had her own ladies' party in another section of the palace. So they started arguing about who was the most beautiful of the women of the 127 provinces and kingdoms. Everyone piped up with their thought. And Ahasuerus said, well, you know, you can't compare. Your ladies are okay, but, you know, the Persian women are the best. They're the Mona Lisa. Well, I guess not Mona Lisa. They're the Marilyn Monroe, right? And I happen to have married the most lovely of them all, Vashti. And he orders Vashti to come, almost like a servant, to his party. And she's ready to go. I mean, again, this is all preordained. This is all planned. And then something goes wrong. She has a little bit of a skin issue. Perhaps she grew a tail. Now, the kids in fourth grade love it, because when the midrash says, she grew a tail, they say, well, she grew a tail? You know, and they even draw with like a tail. So again, what I love doing is interpreting what is meant by she grew a tail. So it's the tail end, you know, the tail is a metaphor for the end of a situation. So growing the tail is her demise, the end of her lineage, Belshazzar and Nebuchadnezzar. So on that seventh day, the king faithfully decides that 70 years have now officially passed since King Nebuchadnezzar destroyed Solomon's temple in Jerusalem, And the Jews have not rebuilt their temple. So it's safe to mess with the Jews. And what does he do? He takes out 8 vestments that were worn specifically by the high priest, the Kohen Gadol. And he wears them at the party. Achashverosh. Big guy. And he orders via his messenger, the queen should come. The queen doesn't want to come because she's not looking farpitzed. It's a nightmare. She has a breakout of copious acne, whatever help boils. Some skin disease breaks out. She doesn't want to come looking like this. And in her anger at being invited, but being unable to attend, which was the plan, she writes a fateful reply to the king. I always joke to the kids, I would not want to have been the messenger to deliver the queen's message. You know, the Caesar's messengers, they was not a... Yeah, it was not a happy experience to be the one delivering the message to Caesar. So she writes, authors, if you will, a reply. And the reply is given to the king and to his inner circle, waiting for, of course, the queen to do his bidding. No, who are you to invite me? I, daughter of Belshazzar and Nebuchadnezzar, a legitimate royal member of the pedigree of the house of King Nebuchadnezzar. Who are you? You're nothing. Achashverosh, if you were alive when my Zadie, when Nebuchadnezzar was alive, you would have been cleaning up the poop in the barn with the animals. That's your gig. Mm-hmm. So you can imagine the poor messenger reading, not only will Her Royal Highness not come, but she says that you are basically a farmhand. So the king is shell-shocked. So in this one moment, the entire plan, the 6 months of the party and the 7 days, the whole political game has been nuclear option because of Vashti. So he wants, in his visceral response, to get rid of Vashti. But he can't. You know why? Because unfortunately for the king, he was the king. But there was a political machine that was set up. He had Congress and the Senate. Well, I don't have to tell you how horrible Congress and Senate. They can be at stalemates and loggerheads and nothing ever gets done. So there was a protocol of how you would go about removing the queen. And so he first decides, well, I'm going to get the smarty guys to advise me. So he calls the rabbis in. So the local rabbis come in. He lays out his sin against him, what Vashti did as an affront. And he says, rabbis, what should we do? So the rabbis say, excuse me, Your Royal Highness, we need to have a little conference call here. So they leave the room, and the rabbis are smart. They say, oh my gosh, this is bad. If we tell the king right now, off with her head, which is what he wants, he's asking us for license, then tomorrow morning he'll wake up and have the migraine, but then he'll have us to blame, and we're dead. But if now we say to him, do not hurt Vashti, then we are jeopardizing our standing with him now, because in his stupor, in his drunken rage, he may take it out on us. So they did a very smart thing. Your Royal Highness, the wisdom is not ours. We don't know. So then he assembles his 7 wise men, and they're listed from the most chashuv, the most important, to the least. And the list goes down. And the last on the list was a man named Memuchan. And he's 7th because he's the lowest on the totem pole. And all the other 7 are probably thinking about what the rabbis are thinking. And they don't say a word. They say, we're not sure. And this guy, Memuchan, he pipes up. And he doesn't just pipe up. He gives full advice and imparts to the king every little piece of the strategy, and the king amazingly buys into it. And Memuchan says, Your Royal Highness, it is not enough that the queen insulted you. She also insulted every male of the population of your kingdoms, because everyone will hear that the king ordered his queen to come and she said no. So no wife will look at their husband the same. They're not going to take commands anymore. We'll lose the patriarchal society, heaven forbid, right? Right? There's no suffragette movement there in Persia, right? So nobody will ever honor their husbands again. So it's not just a sin against you on a local level, it's a universal crime, and we have to treat it as such. And so you should dispatch the queen, and then let a letter be sent out to all the kingdoms, all 127, that this is what happened to a queen who disrespected, who Rodney Dangerfielded her husband. And it will be a statement. And the king loved it. And he buys into Memucan's etza, to his advice. Now, who was Memucan? So the rabbis in the Talmud and Megillah say Memucan is Haman. What? Why don't we just call him Haman? Haman. We call him Haman later. I mean, what? We're worried about an extra couple grogger shakes in synagogue when we hear his name? I mean, what's going on? So the Gemara then is going to discuss why he's called Memucan. But before we get there, it's going to get kind of interesting, I hope. Haman is the least of the advisors. And yet the king fully buys into the world of Haman. And this is a very important moment because it makes the king dependent upon Haman forever. So Haman has the upper hand with the king, and he's a very smart guy. Yeah, he's evil. But, you know, he's an evil villain. He's the Joker. Joker is a brilliant, sadistic, horrible person, yes, but he's brilliant. So he's an evil genius, Haman, and he manipulates the king. And he forces the hand, and the king buys in. And so they vanquish Vashti. She's either killed or sent off into exile with Napoleon, never to return again, you know. And she's gone. And then they send out this letter. And this is important, too, because this letter is the first official royal communique from this new king, Ahasuerus. Everyone has to be a man in their house. And, of course, the people scratch their heads and say, we already are the masters of my domain. Why do I need the king to tell me? This is a davar pashut. It's simple. We are that. So why do I need this? So that's an important thing also. So why, oh why, is Haman called Memucan? Why don't we just call him Haman? So the Talmud says something fascinating. Why is he called Memucan? The word Memucan comes from the word Muchan. Hachana, preparation. Preparation. In fact, there's a little verse some of you may recognize in your youth from your Haggadah. Before we do the four cups of wine, we say, Hineni mezuman memuchan mezuman. Here we are prepared and ready to perform the following commandment of drinking four glasses of grape juice or wine. Okay? So it means prepared. Oh, why do we call him Memucan? Why don't we just call him Haman? Haman? Oh, because he's Muchan Lefuranut, the Talmud and Megillah says. He is prepared to take a fall. He's prepared to be punished. Okay. But what does that mean? Well, we're going to explore that in the next few minutes together, shall we? So, let's now back up for a moment and discuss the rise of Haman. So Haman has visions of grandeur, and of course we know that there but Esther he would have. But of course there's a couple other delicious little tidbits that I want to point out to you. Remember I mentioned to you that he needed the counsel of the wise men to help him solve the Vashti question, correct? Haman went beyond just the advice. He essentially gave powers to the king that the king had not previously possessed. Unilateral dictatorial powers. And he basically said, Your Royal Highness, you're the king. You don't need the Senate, the Congress. Just say the following words out loud. Off with her head. See what happens. So the king's looking around and he says, really? That's all I need to do? Yeah, try it. So the king says, off with her head. Boom, they go, they arrest Vashti and she's dispatched. It's over. Now what's amazing is these dictatorial powers were only used twice in the history of Shushan that we know of. One is right here to dispatch Vashti. You want to take a guess the only other time this happened? When Haman is dispatched summarily later in the story. When Haman comes to ask permission, you know, the gallows, etc. And then later on, the party happens, and the second party happens. And at that party, of course, everything is about a party and having lots of wine, because that's what Purim's all about. And at that second party, the queen points to Haman and says, Ish Sarvayev, there's this nefarious, horrible individual. She points to Haman. And he doesn't know what to do. And he remembers, wait a minute, Haman, thank you, Yashakoach, you gave me the dictatorial powers. Off with his head. And so they cover his head with a black, you know, mask, and they take him out and they hang him on the gallows. Mm-hmm. So Haman gave the license to the king to kill himself. But it's better than that. Who allowed Esther, who ultimately kills him, to become the queen? It was all Haman, right? Haman is the one who says, get rid of Vashti, thereby opening the door to the royal selection. Esther becomes queen, and years later, he's history. So now we can begin to understand a little bit of what the Talmud is saying. That he's Mr. Preparation, yes. He's the ultimate Boy Scout. He's prepared like nobody else. However, he's prepared to die, to take a fall, to be punished. That's his ultimate destiny. So how does this fit in with the Megillah? How does this fit in with the Haman? So here, I think, is an amazing concept. So let me share with you a Midrash. So a Midrash, the oral tradition, says the following. And it just relates directly to the story of Esther, okay? But before I tell you this Midrash, let's go fast forward. And I hope you know this part of the story. If you don't, I'll tell it to you very briefly, okay? So later in the story, Haman constructs gallows. And they are huge. They're 50 amot tall. They're gallows that are built, some say, from Noah's Ark, you know, wood. Like the really big gallows, okay? Very public execution. And he wants to execute Mordecai the Jew, who is his archenemy. And so he's waiting out in the chatzar. He's waiting outside in the courtyard at 3 o'clock in the morning. Because he's, with bated breath, he needs the king's permission to off Mordecai. He can't just kill Mordecai. Yes, he's the premier, but he's not the king. So he's making noise out in the courtyard. And what happens to Achashverosh that night? This is a famous story. You probably know it from your Megillah expertise. The king can't sleep. And so he asks one of his keepers to get out a book of Chronicles. Start reading the Chronicles to him. The history of the kingdom. And he had two chronicle books. One had been edited by Haman. And Haman's version of the Chronicles, years before, two of the chamberlains, guys who were bodyguards, secret service guys for the king, plotted Bigthan and Seresh with their names, and they wanted to murder the king. But Mordecai was apprised of the plot, reports it to Esther, she reports it to King Achashverosh in the name of Mordecai, and they foil the would-be assassination of Bigthan and Seresh, and they write down in the Chronicles that Mordecai the Jew, the head rabbi, saved the king's life. But Haman edited it out. He took some white out, and he put in, Haman saved the life of the king, and therefore it was just put away. But unbeknownst to Haman, there was a second set of books. And those books were inside the palace, untouchable and unreachable by Haman. So the night that the king can't sleep, he asked for the Chronicles to be read because they're boring. They're just basically, you know, a history, a chronology of all the events of the last years of the kingdom. And he's falling asleep. And the page keeps opening to the story of how these two assassins wanted to kill Achashverosh and how Mordecai the Jew saved his life. And then the king is wide awake now. He says, I vaguely remember this story, but I don't remember Mordecai. I remember Haman being involved. You mean Mordecai saved my life? And then he asks, of course, famously, well, how did I reward the Jew? Did I give him shares in Microsoft? No. A new Rolls Royce? No. Zilch. Nada. Bubkus. You gave him nothing. So at that point, he hears some noise outside. And the king's a little bit of a paranoid lunatic. So he asks, who's this guy outside making the noise in the courtyard? The Haman ba. And they bring Haman in. And Haman's there. And Haman's waiting to do what? To ask King Ahasuerus for a license to kill Mordechai. The king, 1 minute earlier, what did he just find out about Mordechai? That Mordechai was his only true friend. That here Haman had been baloneying him for all these years, manipulating him, and that Mordechai had saved his life, not Haman. And so he's anxious, the king is, to honor Mordechai. So Haman doesn't know any of this. Haman is just coming to get permission to execute the one friend that the king knows, Mordechai. Talk about bad timing. And so the king says to Haman, what should I do for the man who I want to honor more than any other man in the kingdom? So Haman, talk about ego here. Ego really is big. He thinks to himself, well, obviously he's talking about me. And I have more money than God. So money is irrelevant to me. So what would matter to me? Well, Your Royal Highness, you should take this person, and put him on the horse that the king rides on. Yeah? And dress him in the king's royal crown and garments. And parade him around the streets of Shushan, the capital, and yell out, this is what is done to honor the man that the king wants to bestow kavod, grandeur, and glory upon. And so Ahasuerus thinks and says, you know, Haman, you're always dead on. I love it. Let's implement your plan. We'll take, and he's waiting for his name to be mentioned, we're going to take Rabbi Mordechai. In fact, Haman, you're in charge of the honor. You'll lead the horse around the kingdom. You'll dress Mordechai, and you'll walk him around the kingdom on the king's horse. And of course, the famous story, the Jewish people see Mordechai, the Jew, being paraded in honor, Yatzav mi HaMelech, he came out in great honor. It's a famous, famous part of the story. Okay, so here's my question. I explained to you an approach. Why would Haman ask for this type of reward? I mean, let's be honest. I don't care how much money you have. You can do better than getting a one-off little reward. I get to ride the king's horse for a couple minutes, and I get a crown on my head. But it makes sense if you have all the money in the world, and money means nothing to you, that what would be of value to you? Honor. Okay? Great. But I could do better if I promise you, if Elon Musk said, Rabbi Kaplan, I want to honor you. You know, a new Tesla in my driveway, you know. I can think of some things that would come before I get a horse, although it does relate in a second, because we'll see. So that always bothered me, the horse thing, right? The king's horse, riding the king's horse. So what if I told you the following medrash that I alluded to, okay? The oral tradition teaches us, Lemaha olam domeh. What is our world compared to? It's compared, prepare yourself, to a horse and a rider. And then the Medrash says, and who, pray tell, is in charge? Is it the horse or the rider? So the Medrash goes on to say, well, from a distance, it would look like the horse is large and powerful and majestic, secretariat, and there's a little scrawny jockey on it, 120-pound guy leading the horse. So ostensibly, one would think that the horse is leading the rider. Medrash says, no. It's not true. The rider is leading the horse. What did Haman ask for? A horse that he should be the rider on the king's horse. We have a tradition in the Megillah that whenever it says the king, without specifically mentioning the name of Ahasuerus as the king, it's a direct reference to the king, God. So when Haman says to the king, Ahasuerus, I want to ride the king's horse, and I want to have the crown of the king on me, he is on a different level. Obviously, he's not saying this to Ahasuerus, the flesh and blood king, but in his own mind, his own ego, his own power, he sees himself as the rider on a horse. Right? It's unmistakable, because that's what he asks for, which parallels directly this comparison of the nature of our world. The nature of our world is you have a horse and a rider. Who leads who? The rider leads the horse. You want to hear something amazing? And this relates to why I chose the Tesla. How do you quantify, historically, energy? Okay, I know I have people here who can literally quantify energy. And in Europe, you have kilowatts. So you buy yourself a Tesla or a Ferrari. It's not sexy. They'll say, this is the engine puts out X amount of kilowatts per. Okay, that's not fun. But we have a much neat horsepower. Horsepower. Every guy and every girl who gets Twitter-pated with cars, it's all about, okay, how much horsepower? What's the 0 to 60, right? Oh my gosh, I got the new Shelby Cobra with 450 brake horsepower. And now, have you ever thought about how arcane this? It's so arcane that it goes back to a time of yesteryear where we would measure how much work a horse could do in an hour. And that is horsepower. I don't know that arithmetic, do you? I don't think you do. I don't. But I know what horsepower, right? If you say I got a new Corvette with 500 brake horsepower, I can relate to what a 500 brake horsepower, it's fast, right? It's a lot. So we quantify energy, amazingly, by horsepower. What if this Medrash is speaking about horsepower? So what would horsepower be a metaphor for? Our energy that we put into this world. We are in this oral tradition, we are quantifying our input as a human being. What we put into this world, the planning, the energy, the involvement, it is horsepower. Yeah? So let's now try to understand what Haman believes. He believes, because remember, nobody planned in the history of the world like Haman. Do you remember that weird Talmud quote, and we haven't yet answered it? Why is Haman called Memuchan, Mr. Preparation? And we said, the Talmud says very strangely, he's prepared to take a fall. Joyce, do you mind closing the door? Is there like a chant going on next door? What's going on?
I don't know.
Thank you, Joyce. Toda rava. I'm trying to quantify what that has to do with our talk. Whoa. All right. We won't go there. So, Haman is described as, in our first chapter, not by his real name, remember. He's called Mr. Preparation. And the rabbis say, in the world's history, no one ever prepared themselves better than Haman. Every detail. The date, the timing of the destruction of the Jews, all the little minutiae, Haman was the best. So what was Haman's attitude? Fantastic attitude, right? Here's Haman. I am going to prepare massive amounts of preparations. We're quantifying those preparations now as energy, as horsepower, my investment in this world. And I'm going to throw all that investment out, and maybe some of it will stick. And in the end, it will bring about the downfall of Mordecai, my hated archenemy, and the Jews. Because I am going to ride the horse. The horse is the horsepower that I have given to the world, all the energy and preparation that I've amassed. And I will direct it as the rider of the horse where that energy should go. Right? Because that's what Haman believed. I will ride the king, God's horse. I will supply the details. I'll supply all that preparation because he's Mr. Preparation. And what does God say to Mordecai, to Haman? He says, bravo, Haman, yasher koach, well done. I'm going to use every little detail that you manufactured and that you plotted against the Jews. And I'm going to turn it around, v'nahapachu. And I'm going to use your energy to kill you. So therefore, whatever you decide, I'm going to bring it back on you. Or you want to build gallows to hang Mordecai? Mazel tov, you'll swing from the gallows. You want to ordain such and such a day as a day of destruction? It will be a Jewish holiday called Purim. You, every little detail, you want to get rid of Vashti and give execution powers to the king to get rid of Vashti? Well, number one, thank you very much, because that's my way of getting Esther in to get rid of you. And in that moment, when you are approaching the king, he'll use those extrajudicial powers to off with your head. Mazel tov. So in other words, the Talmud is telling us something astounding. All the preparation that Mr. Preparation did, because he's Memucha, Mr. Preparation, all of it is going to be utilized by God, because God is the ultimate rider of that horse, not you, Haman. It will always be Hashem. And you're going to be going for a ride. And in your last moments of your life, as the black hood is put over you, and you're walking to your demise, to your denouement, to be hanged, all of this will go through your head. You will realize that all the preparation that you did, I will use in my way to undermine you. Now, this is an amazing concept, because this is how our world works. This is an insight to our world. What do I mean by that? We do the best we can. We're human. We don't have divine aspirations, and we don't have the divine insight. But the best we can do is to offer up our investment in this world through our good deeds, through our prayers, through our charity, through our kindness, and we push it out there. We can't know, nor should we know, exactly how God's going to take our horsepower that we have expended and utilize that. And that's the magic of life. How many times in life have you been pushing towards a goal, and then the goal deviates slightly and it goes to someone else, and the focus becomes clear? Oh my gosh, I thought it was here. In fact, it's here. And this is the magic of life, is that we can learn from Haman. Not that we shouldn't do preparation, but don't over-prepare. Because ultimately, Hashem, God, wins out the day. He's the rider on that horse. And so all the input, we should still put as massive amounts that we can accrue towards all these good goals. And we should pray. But you know what? Tragically, not every prayer can be answered in the way we think it could be answered. So there may be tears that we've all shed for a loved one, and the loved one didn't get the benefit, perhaps, from our tears, and they passed. They didn't get better. But I promise you, there is someone else in our world that benefited from your prayers, your charity, and your tears. It could be that you focused it on your dear old grandma. You wanted her to recover, and she didn't. And it's heart-rending and heartbreaking when that happens, obviously. But know that the tears were not wasted. They're applied somewhere else. Maybe there's a little girl, a cancer patient at St. Jude's in Memphis, who's the beneficiary of your prayers that you ushered with such heart. And that's the nature of our world, is that it's unknowable. We don't know at the end of the day how the application of what we say is going to be utilized. But I promise you, it will be utilized. And I'll share a quick little story with you, and then we'll call it a day. Okay, it's a real story. Jewish man loses his dad, and he lives in the tri-state area. And he's very conscientious, and he wants to say the Kaddish prayer for his late father every day, three times a day. And everything's working well, but 6-7 months into the 12 months of mourning, business takes him towards the Cincinnati, Lexington, Kentucky area, which, by the way, happens to be the head of horsepower in our world. You know, that's where the bluegrass is, right below Cincinnati. All the great farms and secretariat, they all come from that area. So it's kind of neat, all right? That was just by coincidence that it happens to be. Okay. So this man is desperate to not miss a Kaddish for his father. And when he looks at the plane schedule, his plane is leaving the airport there in the Lexington, Cincinnati area, and he's going to go back east, and he'll miss the time. By the time he lands, he won't be able to get a mincha, an afternoon prayer, and he'll miss one prayer. He doesn't want to miss the prayer. So he starts calling the synagogues in the Cincinnati area. Hey, are you going to have a minyan, you know, sometime an hour or two before my flight? Nobody can help him. And he calls a local Chabad house in the area. And the Chabad rabbi says, look, I don't normally have a service at all during the week. We have like only on Sabbath, Shabbat mornings. But for you, in your case, I'll get eight other guys, and we'll get a minyan for you. Beautiful, the man says. Tell me where to be. He says, no. The airport's a little convoluted, how to get from here to there. We'll visit you in the airport. We'll bring the minyan to you. So the man's very, very grateful, and he arranges it all, and he's out there for his business trip. And then business is done, he comes to the airport, he's waiting patiently, and it happens to be the Thursday before Super Bowl Sunday. So all the airport's TVs, of course, have previews of the big game. And the Dallas Cowboys are playing one of their big games somewhere around 96, 97 when they had the big team. Now, he doesn't know anything about sports, and he doesn't care. So he's sitting there patiently waiting, looking at his watch, looking at the time for the flight. And he's waiting for the Chabad rabbi to bring the eight men, and they'll have a minyan. He'll be able to say Kaddish with the quorum. Beautiful. And that this giant man is sitting there. And the guy's wearing like a one-piece, looks like something out of like a hillbilly, you know, suit. And he's a big guy. He's like 6'5", 6'6". He's sitting next to him, and he looks over at this man. And he's sitting next to him, and he's smiling. He's looking up at the camera where the Dallas Cowboys are being previewed. And he says, "My boys will not lose this Sunday." So this Jewish man doesn't really know who he's talking about. Who are the boys, your boys? But he looks up, and he sees, okay, must be the Dallas Cowboys. And the man says, "My name's Hurley." That's all, Hurley. And for the next 20 minutes, Hurley starts, and he's a very nice, jovial guy, starts eloquently giving him everything he ever wanted or not did not want to know about the Dallas Cowboys and why they're going to win on Sunday. Okay, 20 minutes pass, and the Jewish man looks down. He sees coming through the airport the Chabad rabbi. He sees the beard, and he sees there's like about eight men coming with him. So he says to Hurley, he says, "It's been really interesting, you know, hearing about the Cowboys. Good luck with your team on Sunday. I got to go. Those men are coming to me." So Hurley kind of wakes up from his reverie about the Cowboys, and he turns to the man, and he says, "How do you know that those men are coming to you?" So he says to Hurley, he says, "Well, I'm Jewish, and I lost my father, and those men are coming so that we can have what's called a minyan, 10 men, a quorum, so I can say a special prayer for my late dad." So Hurley looks at the man and says, "You know, I'm Jewish." He says, "I lost my mom 3 months ago, and I never went to Hebrew school. I don't know anything. I've never said a prayer for her, not once. Would you allow me to accompany you and say a prayer with you when you're praying?" The man said, "Of course." So Hurley comes with the nine other men, now they have 11, and they go off to a quiet area in the airport, and they daven mincha, they have the afternoon prayer. And then the man stands next to Hurley, and Hurley is standing, you know, erect, and his eyes are closed, and he's chuckling, and he's crying, and he's going word by word, and Hurley's repeating every word, "Yit gadol, yit gadol." And the tears are just flowing. The first and only time in his life he's ever said a prayer for his mom, his late mother. And after, all the other men are coming around congratulating Hurley and saying hello to him. And he goes over to the Chabad rabbi. He thanks him. He says, "You know," he says, "I want to thank you for orchestrating all this so that I could say Kaddish." And the rabbi looks at the Jewish businessman. He says, "I think you got it wrong. We're not really here for you. We're here for him." And he points to Hurley. So that's how life is. We plan. Boy, do we plan. We plan to make sure we have all the details. And then God says, "Beautiful. I appreciate your plan. It's not going to be exactly the way you envision. It's going to be close. And I appreciate all your input and all your energy to make sure that it was done. But you know, someone else needs also a little help here. And I'm going to take your energy that you supply." So my prayer for all of us, that we should continue our investment in this world and never lose faith or hope, that whatever you supply in our world, the energies, your hopes, your prayers, your charity, your generosity of heart, it's not going to be wasted. Never, God forbid, have that attitude. Always understand that Hashem has a divine plan. God's going to use our horsepower in the most magical way. We should all merit to give Ferraris as gifts to our world with copious amounts of horsepower to help bring our world back from the darkness. This is the time of Purim. La Yehudim hayta ora v'simcha. That for the Jewish people, to quote from the Megillah, they had ora v'simcha. We should know light and joy in our lives. Thank you.